We have an exciting episode for you today featuring director Edgar Wright and the cast of the Stephen King adaptation, The Running Man, coming soon to a theater near you. But before we jump into that, I wanted to give you a heads up about another podcast that might be of interest to KingCast listeners. You may have heard about this little show on HBO called It Welcome to Derry. It's from the creative team of Andy and Barbara Muschietti, who made the most recent super successful It films. Well, they're back with a talented team of new creatives and a great new cast to tell a different story about a new cycle of everybody's favorite murder clown. That's right, we're talking about dat boy Pennywise. HBO isn't content with just launching a massive new show. They're also bringing you the official It Welcome to Derry companion podcast hosted by the wonderful Mark Bernardin and Princess Weeks. Mark is a super successful film reporter, comic book writer, and podcaster. He's been on the KingCast before. The dude knows the Stephen King stuff. Princess is a horror nerd through and through. So, of course, that makes them the perfect people to lead this official show by HBO. Every week, as soon as a new episode drops, they are there, joined by Andy and Barbara Muschietti, as well as the cast each week, as they dive deep into the makings of this extremely popular and successful show. Make sure to check it out. Stream new episodes of HBO's It Welcome to Derry Sundays on HBO Max, and listen to the It Welcome to Derry official podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and they are better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine or in the new fancy digital subscription, if you've heard about that. But in order to get access to any of that, you're going to need to join in the fun by subscribing, and to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping astronomical, massive, gigantic 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Guys, we're gonna go see a dead body.
Sometimes that is better.
Welcome back to the KingCast and the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts.
We are your hosts.
One of these days, we're actually going to sync that up, and it's going to be one of those, like, we're going to have to do a virtual high five about it. So we got a really cool, I think, episode for you guys today. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of an odd one.
Multifaceted episode.
We got 4 whole ass guests, none of them ever in the same place with each other. But yeah, do you want to kind of set up, what we have in store and kind of the stuff that's right up top?
Yeah, you bet. We're talking about the new version of The Running Man, a book that Stephen King wrote in the early 70s before he published Carrie. He published it in, 1982? Is that right?
81 or 82, yeah.
Under the name Richard Bachman, one of the Bachman books, the notorious evil Bachman books. It was made into a film in the late 80s, I want to say 87, right, Eric? You checked me on the dates. With Arnold Schwarzenegger as the eponymous hero who's on the run for his life in a game show where you either win the jackpot or you die trying. Mm-hmm. And not a very faithful adaptation, that movie. This version from director and co-writer Edgar Wright is extremely faithful, surprisingly faithful, right down to a lot of the specific details. And so we talked to Edgar. That's sort of the back end of today's show. We talked to him for a long, long time. And then we get a kind of lightning round with some of the stars of the new movie, including Glenn Powell, Josh Brolin, and Lee Pace. Yeah. Who plays McCone, one of the hunters chasing him. Glenn Powell is Ben Richards. That's the Schwarzenegger part, the good guy on the run. Yeah. And Josh Brolin, a.k.a. Thanos, is once again the big bad of this movie. he is the smiling executive producer who makes a lot of money and kills a lot of people and causes a lot of pain, but just can't get enough out of it. Enjoys the hell out of it. And he's got a great story about his teeth. So we'll tease that. Yeah. And I guess We'll just take it with this is an unusual circumstance where you get people in this sort of rapid fire way. Eric, like, what's it like? You want to, what's it like for you?
It's, I mean, it's something I think I was better at back in my movie reporter days because, I mean, I've always been a conversational interviewist. So these, you know, in this case, it was 4 minutes a piece that we got with the actors. The don't worry, Edgar, you're getting a full episode's worth. You know, Edgar's gave us quite a bit more time, but we couldn't get more time with those guys. But you know, doing this as the host of the show, like 4 minutes is basically the time that we take to warm up the guest at the beginning and kind of get them, you know, with the, you know, chit chat portion and getting them comfortable and all that. And this kind of 4 minute rapid fire, or as you called it, speed dating, you know, version of interviewing is way more kind of suited for the sound bite generation, the quick hits on TikTok that you see. So it is a little, I feel a little bit out of my element. That said, I'm think, you know, especially Brolin, like I think Brolin, you like came kind of loaded for bear. Glenn Powell was great, Lee Pace was great, and each are a different flavor of interview too. I don't know if you noticed that. Like Glenn Powell is like very much the professional star of the show, and you know, we kind of you can hear him moving the conversation to the movie and the topic at hand, and you know, in a very charming and pleasant way. And Lee Pace is like the reader. He was the one that kind of shows up and is like, oh no, I actually know Stephen King stuff. I've read Stephen King. And then Josh Brolin, you know, he's in his I don't give a fuck, you know, I'm gonna talk about whatever I'm gonna talk about, and you'll hear what he says there. So I think it turned out well. It's definitely not the format of the show, but I think as like a little addition to the chunkier interview that we have with Edgar, I think that it plays off really well. And you know, you guys will have to let us know what your thoughts are, because I do, you know, for a lot of these bigger name actors, you know, especially when they're attached to Stephen King stuff, the time that we can get them is during a junket, and during a junket is when you can't really get a huge amount of time with people. So.
You basically it's like volleyball. You know, if you've ever played volleyball, like they have that thing where somebody taps the ball and sets it up for another person to spike it over. When you do rapid fire interviews like this, that's essentially the premise is you get one, essentially one question. We went with a King Cast classic, so we'll let you listen to those answers now.
All right, so yeah, listen to the speed dating portion, and we'll be back before the full-blown Edgar interview.
What's up, guys? How are we doing?
Doing
Doing
great. How about
well.
yourself?
Good, 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 good.
Yeah, I'm coming in from a place you know well. I'm an Austin, Texas boy,
Hell
so.
yeah. Hell yeah. Awesome. Are you guys both in Austin?
Oh
No,
no.
I'm just north of LA, so
Northern.
coming at you from two different
Wow. Yeah.
directions. Not as cool, I guess.
Definitely the Tex-Mex isn't as good, or barbecue, but that we'll leave that for another discussion. Yeah.
Good, good.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, man. This is really exciting. We are obviously big Stephen King nerds, and we wanted to kind of kick off with a question for you, Glenn, that we ask everybody that's come on the show, and that is, what's your Stephen King origin story? And that could be, what's the first, you could mean like, you know, when's the first time you popped up as a presence in pop culture for you? So it could be a movie, a book, could be, you know, just seeing his face on a
General
poster.
awareness.
You know what's, I don't know if you guys have ever met this director, Josh Boone, but I did a movie a long time ago, small role, one scene, movie called Stuck in Love. And it's about a family of writers. And Stephen King actually has a cameo in the movie.
A
I don't know if
voice
you guys have.
cameo, doesn't he? It's a
Was
voice
it?
cameo because he calls his phone and leaves him
Exactly.
a message, so he's not on
So,
camera.
yeah, so Steve, but Stephen King was sort of like a, everybody was so excited about just the presence of Stephen King around that movie. Obviously, he's one of the most prolific writers ever. I've gotten it, and just it's never lost on me whenever, like, I just worked with J.J. Abrams, and obviously Edgar and Stephen are friends now. But every time an email comes in from Stephen King with just any sort of idea or note, it just feels magical. I mean, he's one of the great minds of our time. And I mean, just the fact that he had to write this book under Richard Bachman, shows how prolific he was. He was worried about saturating the market so much He was so prolific that he had to change his name to, like, you know, make sure he didn't feel like he was diluting the market. That shows you what a brain he has. And I think, you know, for me, this was such a wonderful drum roll to this story. I mean, Running Man is one of the great stories. And really, Stephen King's book has not been told on screen. I mean, obviously,
no.
There's the original movie, but, you know, they took a lot of creative license with that movie in terms of there's still a great concept at its core. But I think what I'm really proud of is that we really stuck to Stephen King's, you know, vision here. You know, Stephen just lost his mind for the movie, just loved it, you know, and just loved what we did with it. And the fact that, you know, the book is set in 2025, we get to release this movie in 2025. Right. There's just so many magical elements around it like that, that is just cool.
You said you got a note from him or you got some messages from him. What's a suggestion he gave that you guys found useful?
You know, I think the thing that you know, Edgar, I mean, that's probably more of an Edgar question about
all right.
Who's sort of guiding the world. For me, I mean, Stephen gave me a really long leash in terms of how to play Ben Richards, which was really good of him. You know, he sort of said go with God, you know, and Edgar, I think he was just like, all right, is you know, Ben Richards is definitely angry. There's a charge to him. I don't know if you've seen the movie yet.
Yeah, we saw it. Yeah. And
okay, so I mean,
The book, this is the book, the original paperback from the 80s, but you captured the anger. Like, he's really pissed off at the beginning. Yeah. And even when he's doing his interview, he's saying things to be provocative and be pushy and push buttons. So that's something you definitely took from the pages of the book. And
that's exactly right. Script, right. That was one of my favorites, like those sort of like, you know, trials to try out for the show. So, like, that was one of the first things we shot. And, you know, that was one of those things is you want to make sure the anger is justified. But, you know, I think one of the things that I just love about this story is it's so clearly these two worlds, you know, mm-hmm. that are sort of colliding in this movie. And you just show this sort of underdog, you know, who's up against the most oppressive system, you know, and a rigged system, and about how a guy just, like, fights against, you know, unbelievable odds to take on an unwinnable game. It's just so cool. But, like, that's one of the things I think I'm most proud of is, like, it's a gear that's kind of hard to nail, you know, and I think people shy away from it. So I'm just really proud that, you know, Edgar and I didn't shy away from, you know, what I think is the sort of emotional driving force of Ben Richards.
We need more pissed off good guys in our
exactly.
More righteous anger. Well, thank you so much for your time, man. Like, we could talk your ear off all day about Stephen King fun stuff, but we appreciate you taking a little time out of your day to
this is speed dating, so we gotta
yeah, we gotta go on to the next one.
Well, I appreciate you guys seeing it, man. Thank you guys so much.
Take care, Glenn.
All right, later. Bye.
All right, bye.
This is round two of our Running Man speed dating on the King cast. We talked to Glenn Powell. Now we have Lee Pace, who plays McCone, one of the hunters in the new movie from Edgar Wright. Lee, one of the questions we always ask when people are on the King cast is, what is your Stephen King origin story? And that could be any awareness that you had of him the first time you heard of this guy, his books, and his reputation.
From when I was about 16 till about 20, I was a huge Stephen King fan. It was like I mostly read Stephen King books. I read The Stand, I read Cujo, I read Pet Sematary, The Shining, It. I was Gerald's Game.
That's a good one.
oh my God, I still think about certain moments in that book. Mm-hmm. There was that time, and not only did I love the stories, but I loved how he wrote basically the perfect chapter. Mm-hmm. It's like there is something concise. You want to get to the next chapter after you've finished one. I mean, he is an absolutely brilliant writer, and, yeah, so that's my answer to your question.
How did you get turned on to Stephen King? Did you just stumble across him, or was it something like, was it on one of your parents' bookshelves? You know, that's how I came to King. I started a little early. I was in sixth grade when I picked up Cujo, but that was because my mom had it on her bookshelf.
I don't even remember, but I have the Stand was the first one, and I have this very vivid memory of being on a family camping trip and refusing to leave the trailer, the camper, to like do family things like canoe and hike because I was so obsessed with the stand and I could not get my nose out of that book.
Yeah. Those are the kind of problems that like modern parents, like I'm a dad of two kids, like that would be a dream come true. Like the kid is too busy reading. Like we're trying to get them off their phones, but like reading would be like, oh yes.
Reading about the end of days.
You were just preparing yourself. You didn't realize it. You were preparing yourself for 2020. That's all you were
Yeah,
doing. You're getting
exactly.
ready. Well, being a big Stephen King fan, then was there ever a role that you would like would be kind of a dream role for you to play in the Stephen King universe?
I'm having a great time with McCone. I mean,
Well,
I love the way
obviously
he's written in
you've made
that
that.
book. So, I mean, I would say that, but I guess, I'm going to sidestep your question by saying, like, I think about Stephen King as a writer of novels. And I think that's, I appreciate reading novels. I appreciate a screenplay in a movie, but I really do think about him as a writer of novels. And so I don't, I guess, really think about what people in those stories I'd want to play. Yeah, when I think about this movie, The Running Man, I think about it as, obviously it's Stephen King's story, but it's told through the eyes of Edgar Wright. He's the one who's bringing, this incredible piece of writing, this, very sensitive of our world here in 2025, written in, 1981, piece of writing to life in 2025.
No, so no, there's not anybody from the stand where you're like, oh man, I would love to have played. Even Franny, you could, any, it doesn't have to matter. You could be anybody in that
Yeah, I'm gonna
story.
play Franny. That's it. That's my
Fran
role.
Goldsmith, you heard it
That's
here
my
first.
right. That's my role. I mean, yeah, The Shining. I mean, that's a what a great, what a feast. But who would dare after Jack Nicholson like played that role so iconically? I mean, talk about, you read it and it's one thing, and then you see an actor like that bring it to life and it becomes like something completely different.
Well, Lee Pace, thank you for being with us on the KingCast. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Anthony Bresnican of the KingCast.
And I'm
Hey,
Eric
Josh.
Vespi of the KingCast. Hey, how's it going?
How are you, man? I'm Josh Prohlen from The Running Man.
I think you're Killian from The Running Man.
Oh, that's right. That's
There
right.
you go.
Thanks.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time, man. It means a lot, and I'm very excited to talk to you about this. But right up front, whenever we have a guest on the show, we like to ask them what their Stephen King origin story is. First time he popped up as a presence in pop culture. It could be a book, movie, whatever.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this a lot, but The Shining was everything, is everything to me. It's never stopped being everything. It's a top 10. And I know that Stephen doesn't necessarily like that version of the movie. I know all that. But, and then Christine, I remember watching when I was young. And that was a movie that I saw a few times. And I ended up working with that actor. What was his name? John Stockwell?
John
Oh yeah.
Stockwell,
Yeah, John Stockwell in Into the Blue. He directed it.
All right, that's
right.
right.
I think he wanted Dean Cain, but I ended up doing the movie.
I think he
he
picked
won out
correctly.
there. Yeah, but how can you not be inundated at some point in your life by Stephen King? He's the best, man.
That's the whole premise of our show, man. We talk to creative people about Stephen King and their favorite stories and influences on him. So
Stephen
you're
King's book on writing is that, and Ray Bradbury, those two books are the best books on writing out there for sure.
Oh, it's incredible. It makes you want to sit down and write a novel when you finish that. It's
It does.
like that and Robert Rodriguez's Rebel
That's
Without a
it.
Crew.
Yeah,
It makes
absolutely.
you want to make a movie.
Genius, genius book.
So you get to play the badass in this movie, Killian, this rich fucker.
Is a
Tell
fuck.
us about the face, because you're doing this thing, this kind of aggressive smile. Every time you smile, it's pretty chilling in this movie. What's going on beneath the hood of that performance?
Fake teeth.
Is that what it is? For
The
real?
veneers. Yeah, Liz Mahoney, my publicist, she looked at the first pictures that were released and she killed them all because she thought something was wrong with me. She's like, "You look weird." And I do look weird, and I had to explain why I look weird. It's interesting in how you go and you create a character and all this, and then how
Mm-hmm.
life gets in the way. Because I had some weird lung infection that wouldn't go away during that time. So I lost a bunch of weight because of it. And when I look at the character, I probably shouldn't say anything. I look at the character and I go, oh, that's the right weight for that guy. He's wearing these really nice suits. He looks polished. And I think part of that was in reaction to me feeling so bad and me being so relaxed. You know, and there was a moment where I looked at Edgar and I said, I think I might not be able to do this movie because I was wheezing so badly. And then he said, well, let's try it anyway. And let's go through a day. And if a day doesn't work, and then the minute we would roll, the wheezing would stop. And then the minute we would cut, the wheezing would come back.
What do you think is going on there?
That's God, man. That's God made me want to do this role.
It's the ghost of Richard Bachman saying this has to
Maybe
be.
it's some kind of Stephen King weird juju.
No, well, I love that the character goes back to the book. And listen, I'm an unabashed fan of the 80s
Oh, right
movie. It
on.
has almost nothing to do with the original book, which is a very
Zero.
mean book.
Yeah.
But
But it's a fun movie and it's a great star vehicle for Arnold.
But I love that you guys go back to the mean, the mean, darker, angry version of it. And I think your Killian absolutely kills it. So thank
Well,
you so much.
thanks, man. Thanks for saying that. I know one of the greatest compliments you can get, at least, you know, for me, is Stephen King seeing it. And Edgar said the first thing he said was he loved the movie, and the second thing he said was something about Killian in a positive way. So I said, that's good.
Well, thank you
All
so
right.
much time
Thanks,
for
Josh.
your time, man. I
Thanks,
really
guys.
appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
All right. That was Lee Pace. That was Josh Brolin. That was Glenn Powell. Our rapid fire, the running man questions. We got some KingCast origin stories out of them. We got a little bit more juice out of the orange that we squeezed. Eric, now we're going to be talking to Edgar Wright. You have a long history with Edgar. Tell us your Edgar Wright origin
Oh
story for the
my.
Edgar cast.
For the Edgar cast, I mean, listen, that could probably support a long-running podcast. That dude's, movies have got, a lot of meat to them. But okay, so the first time I'd ever heard of Edgar Wright was when I got a phone call from the admittedly now disgraced Harry Knowles, but he was my boss at Ain't It Cool News, and he was like, "Hey, there's this British director coming into town. He wants to show me and some of the Ain't It Cool guys, including you, he's got some kind of zombie movie he wants to show, and it's like a and he was like, that's a low budget thing, and he's like, this is his first feature. I'm like, okay, whatever that's gonna be. And he's like, and before we screen the movie, we're gonna go out to the Salt Lick, which is the up until like the barbecue renaissance in Austin, that started with Franklin's and then went on with Terry Black's, the new Texas style of barbecue. This is my favorite barbecue place, and it's well outside of town. It's a whole experience getting out there. And he's like, so we're gonna meet him there. You're gonna pick him up from the hotel, the director, and then we'll go watch the movie. And he's like, I was like, do I know him from anything? He's like, oh, well, he did this like British show that nobody's seen, of course, that
Based.
being Spaced. I admittedly, I hadn't seen it at that point, but I do love that show, and I found it later. But so I picked up this, young director, from his hotel, and drove him out into the boonies. We talk a little bit about that as we go, and he showed us Shaun of the Dead, and that was a trip. He said that he came to America specifically to screen it for George Romero in Pittsburgh, and he decided, he's like, at the time, Ain't It Cool was the preeminent movie nerd website, and the geek, community coalesced there, and he's like, these are my people, and he was like, so I want to kind of show it to these guys. Austin's not all that far away from Pittsburgh. It's a, hour and a half, 2 hour flight. So like, let's figure that out. So my origin story was driving him out in the middle of nowhere, and seeing him kind of look at me at the side of his eye, not knowing I'm a movie geek, but also, I was must have been in my early 20s at this point, and here's a guy he's never met in a country that he
I don't think he'd been to before, driving him out into the middle of nowhere in pitch black Texas night, and going, am I going to end up a body buried out in the cornfield somewhere? So that was my origin with that guy. And since then, I visited multiple of his sets. I've visited him at home. He's visited me here, and yeah. So that's how my relationship with Edgar started. What about you? You mentioned that you go back a little bit with Edgar too, right?
Yeah, go back to basically the same era. I haven't taken him out for barbecue, but
Yeah.
wrote about Shaun of the Dead early on when I was a junior film writer, and I really got to know him on Hot Fuzz, which I think was like 2007. Like that was like just a few years after that. And Hot Fuzz is still one of my favorite movies. I remember a publicist pitching that to me, and they're like, somebody's gonna pay this guy a lot of money to direct films." And like, we had hit it off. I think, there's something about Edgar that's very Terry Thomas-like. That's like an old reference, but I'm guessing you get it.
I
If
know who
you've
Terry
seen,
Thomas is, yeah.
he's like a British comic actor from the 60s, 50s, 60s, maybe early 70s. He was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Was he the voice of Sir Hiss in Disney's Robin
In Robin
Hood?
Hood, I think you might actually be right about that.
Sir Hiss has that little space
He
between his
does.
teeth,
He's got the space between his teeth.
which I have too, which Edgar has too. So we all have the Terry Thomas space, but there's something just about his accent. As we were talking about him, they're talking with him. I was like, oh, wow, he really reminds me of Terry Thomas. But anyway, I moderated a panel at Comic-Con with Edgar and with Mark Webb and Alfonso Cuarón. It was like these three directors in Hall H back around 2012. And what I remember was there was a party after this. Well, there's always parties at Comic-Con, but after this panel, it wasn't f a party for the panel, it was just a random party. And there was a woman at the party, and there was music and dancing and drinks. And she came up to me and she was like, "Hey." And I was like, "Hey, how are you?" Like just shooting the breeze as you do with Comic-Con people. She was a little bit flirty. She was like, "I wanted to talk to you before, but you had security around you." And I was like, "Oh, I did. I don't think I had security around me." And she goes, "What happened to your accent?"
Oh
She thought I was Edgar Wright because I at the time had long, curly black hair, same as Edgar, wavy black hair, and space between my teeth. And she could have sworn, I guess I was the spitting image for Edgar Wright. This slightly tipsy woman at a Comic-Con party mistook me for, I was like, "Oh, you think I'm Edgar?" She was very embarrassed, but it was okay. I looked like his Saddam Hussein double. That's one story. And
That's why
then,
they picked you to moderate it. I know you have the skills, but they were like, you know what? We can get double our value out of this guy. He can moderate it, and he can also be thrown in front of
He
the
could be a
drunk
decoy.
Comic-Con crowd.
So that's just one. That's like my little private Edgar. Edgar wasn't even at that party, so I don't think he has anything to do with that. But we've done a lot of panels here and there over the years. I remember like talking to him about Ant-Man that he was going to make, which is a heartbreaking thing that he
That
didn't
was
make that
another
film for
in
Marvel.
infamous Comic-Con panel where it was Kevin Feige, him, a bunch of Jon Favreau, all the Marvel people, and of course that all ended pretty badly, but
And you'll hear Edgar talk in our conversation, just a little preview of what he's going to say. He talks about not wanting to come on the show to talk about The Running Man until it was all locked and set. I think he's just aware, as Guillermo del Toro is, as many filmmakers are. Those two are just two who famously have a lot of projects that they have a big long wish list that they make public, and then things don't happen, and then they get self-conscious about it. I remember Edgar was going to adapt a really great book called Grasshopper Jungle a few years ago, and I don't think that's going to happen now. But he did get to fulfill his dream of making The Running Man, and we have our conversation coming up with him right now.
Pause Pardon the interruption, everybody. We take a quick break from talking about The Running Man so we can remind you about another massive Stephen King adaptation going on at this very moment and the kick-ass official companion podcast associated with it. We're talking about this week's sponsor, the It Welcome to Derry companion podcast hosted by friend of the show Mark Bernardin and Princess Weeks. It Welcome to Derry is giving us a deeper understanding of dat boy Pennywise as we jump back into the 1960s to see what the killer clown was up to the cycle before he ran into those dastardly annoying kids in the Losers Club. This is an expansion of the 2017 and 2019 films from director Andy Muschietti, using tidbits culled from the massive King tome that have never really made their way into any previous adaptation. The HBO show is already a gigantic hit, and it's easy to understand why. It doesn't pull any punches and really goes for the throat. We're really digging it over here. I hope you guys are too. If you want to know more about the behind-the-scenes stories and insights, then make sure to check out the official It Welcome to Derry podcast, where Mark and Princess are regularly joined by Andy and Barbara Muschietti and the cast to dig deep into all the details of each episode as they air. Stream new episodes of HBO's It Welcome to Derry Sundays on HBO Max, and listen to the It Welcome to Derry official podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's get back to the show.
Thank you.
How you doing, Edgar?
Good.
Been a while.
Are you tired about talking about Running Man yet?
I mean, the press tour only started late yesterday, so not yet.
Okay.
I'm here for you guys, finally.
We'll do our damnedest to make you tired of it by the end of this. Be like, no, oh man, too much mind. Stephen King nerdery going on.
I don't mind.
It's great. Well, thanks so much for doing this. I think a little KingCast behind the curtain, you were one of the very first people I talked to about the show way back in 2020, and we've been toying with getting you on for many a time, but it didn't work out. But I'm glad that it finally worked out when you had your own Stephen King adaptation to talk about.
Well, you know what's funny is part of it, and this actually ties into Stephen himself, which we could get back to, but well, okay, let me preface this, is that I had been in email correspondence with Stephen King for a number of years, because right back to Shaun of the Dead, he had been incredibly generous to give us a press quote for that movie, which as a Stephen King fan was like wild to me. Mm. More recently, we'd sort of been in email contact, maybe around the time of Baby Driver, and had, you know, been sort of emailed back and forth, and sometimes about movies, but mostly about music. Mm-hmm. And you know, I turned into a tradition of me sending him like new rock music on his birthday, and first like digital, and then sending him actual albums of like bands that I was into that I thought he'd dig, like King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard or Sunflower Bean, and just sending him stuff. But I didn't. I've been sort of attached to this movie since like late 2021, and me and Michael Bacall started rolling our sleeves up probably in early 22. I didn't talk to Stephen about it directly until maybe like the summer last year, you know, as we're getting into kind of like a green light stage. And the reason I didn't get in touch with him is because I didn't want to be the boy who cried wolf. The thought of talking to him about it and it not coming together, like the film falling apart, would have been too heartbreaking. So I only got in touch with him about the screenplay once I thought that it was most likely to happen. And of course, when I emailed him, this is emailing him to send him the adaptation because he had sign off on the screenplay. And I, you know, sent him the email. I said, as you are probably aware, I have been working on The Running Man with Michael Bacall for a number of years. Now, in a similar way with the King cast, you've been asking me for years. Mm-hmm. Because I was sort of like working on this, I get it was like almost like too kind of like, it would be too kind of like sad to me to be doing this and it not come together. So I'm happy that this is now finally the occasion.
Well, you know,
the show is having made a Stephen King movie.
Doing the KingCast is not a binding contract.
No, but like, it's too dear to me. I didn't want to let you guys down.
We were just talking about Steve's shout outs for other movies, things that have nothing to do with himself, with Clark Collis, who wrote the book Screaming and Conjuring. I don't know if you've seen that book, but you know, it's, he mentions Shaun of the Dead and King's quote in support of that. Did you feel that helped move the needle? Because you'd made a horror comedy, but what did having Steve's stamp of approval on that mean to the picture?
I mean, we were very fortunate to have a lot of directors weigh in on Shaun of the Dead and that press campaign in the States. Actually, it was actually in the kind of the States, like in the UK, it was like critics, and actually it was like Ain't It Cool, like one of the first sort of US kind of like publications or websites. But it was like, like to first people in the States to kind of make any noise about Shaun of the Dead. So thank you, Eric. You
Well,
were,
that
and
was
that
easy to do
and
because
that's really
we were one of the first people you showed it to.
not only with that, you picked me up in the car from the Omni Hotel in Austin.
I remember very vividly you getting kind of sweaty about because we were taking you to barbecue out at the Salt Lake, which if anybody's familiar with Austin, that's not in Austin. It's a hell of a drive in
Oh yeah.
backwoods country. And I remember there was a certain point where you were like, "So you're actually taking me to a barbecue place here in the dead of night in Texas Chainsaw Massacre country?"
It's also because it's a weird thing. You know, this is when you land in another country, in a city at that point. The first time I'd ever been to Austin, it was also night when I got there. So I kind of had like absolutely no idea where I was. All these things that now make a lot of sense to me as I go to like the Alamo and South Lamar, but obviously this is all new to me. And I was genuinely on my own. There was nobody from Universal with me. I remember it very vividly, and you were very kind. But what I was going to say about the press campaign is that in the US, a lot of directors weighed in, which was amazing. Like Quentin Tarantino and like Frank Darabont and Guillermo and Sam Raimi and Robert Rodriguez. And but Stephen King, not to, it was an author and like the most famous horror author, the most prolific. And so I remember when that came in, me and Simon were just like looked at it and were just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. It was just, and this is somebody whose books I started reading when I was probably like 12 or 13. So yeah, it's just, and in fact, the first ever like secondhand correspondence I had with him was that everybody who gave us a press quote for Shaun of the Dead, as a thank you, we made Shaun's badge with their name on it. So we made a new bunch of badges for 4E Electric, and it was like Sam, Quentin, Guillermo, Robert, Frank, and Stephen. And I didn't have any contact for Stephen King, so I got the Stephen badge to him. Or rather, I was talking to Frank Darabont about something, and I just said, hey, could you ask Stephen King if he ever got his badge? And then Frank forwarded me back an email from Stephen that said, Telega, not only do I have the badge, but I'm wearing it right now. So that was the first ever, kind of correspondent secondhand that I had with Stephen King, which was kind of amazing.
He puts it
Now,
on to show up for work in the morning. That's just
you'd go to
like you
some
do.
conventions wearing a Shaun of the Dead t-shirt.
Yeah, I
Like, I
think
remember seeing that and I was like, this is wild.
the first time that I got to meet, well, the only time I got to meet him in person, I've been lucky enough he's come on the show a couple of times now, which is great, but it's like this, it's over the internet. But the first and only time I got to talk to him in person was at the New York Comic Con when he was promoting Marvel was doing the Dark Tower comic book at that point. And he went out for that, and I got, I was lucky enough to sit down with him, and he was wearing a Shaun of the Dead
No way.
t-shirt. Yeah, so yeah.
Wow,
So I can
man.
vouch for that. So, it sounds like you've been a fan for a while. What's your Stephen King origin story? Like, what's the first time that he popped up for you? Are you a constant reader? Were you like, I assume that my guess is your entry into Stephen King is probably similar to mine, and that was the movies. And then I saw the movies, and then I read the books. But that's just
Yeah.
me taking a stab in the dark. So.
I think, and this goes for a lot of horror films, but a lot of the Stephen King films as well, is also, I grew up in a, my mum and dad didn't have like a VCR. And so there were a lot of movies that I like knew a lot about without actually having seen them. And there used to be a magazine, and well, actually there still is. It went through like a gory period with Alan Jones as the editor, but Starburst magazine in the UK, like in the very early 80s, like had a somewhat controversial like run where they were like had covers as gory as Fangoria. And my dad used to buy me Starburst And it seemed somewhat illicit in the house because it was really like there was a period where it was really gory. Like they had sort of like Lucio Fulci on the cover. And I was like 7 years old, like reading this magazine. And I would be so scared of it. I'd have to sometimes turn the pages double at a time to get to the bit I wanted to read. But through those magazines, you then become aware, like probably the first time I saw an image of Carrie. And probably the shot of Sissy Spacek with the blood and her hands in front of her face looking terrified and not really knowing what it was or about, but the image is like stuck with me. And so it's a funny thing with a movie like that and several others, but Carrie's a good example, where I'd probably seen the photos and seen the poster and wondered what it was actually about based on poster alone and then later VHS cover alone. I used to go to the local video shop and like read the covers. Usually go in the afternoon when there's no grown-ups around and then reach up to the horror section and like look at the cover of Carrie and try and figure out what it was all about. So probably between seeing that photo and seeing the movie is probably like, 8 years, 10 years. So I was definitely aware of the I'm aware of the films, and probably I su suspect the first ones that I saw would have been on TV. So I want to say probably like the first, I want to say like probably the first Stephen King film I saw was probably like Cujo, because I remember Cujo being on TV, and yeah, I think that might be the first one. The first book that I read, I was actually, this is, we'll get to this, but when I actually met Stephen in person like a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to recall what the first one was, and I knew which ones I had copies of and which ones my brother had copies of. But I think the first book that I read was Night Shift, and I think maybe Night Shift and Skeleton Crew were maybe the first two I started with short stories, and the ones that I owned and still own were like Night Shift, Skeleton Crew. And this is when I'm like 14 or 13, 14. It, and then also Salem's Lot. I think my brother had Christine, The Shining, and Pet Sematary, so we like shared some. And I had the Backman books. I had that paperback compendium of
This
Ray.
one?
Yeah, not that cover. There may have been a different cover in the UK. It
All
kind of looks
right.
like a bit like a rock album. It's got like really big, like silver font. But yeah, with Rage, Roadwork, Long Walk, and The Running Man. So I had read that book before I saw the 1987 Schwarzenegger version, because the Schwarzenegger one came out in the UK in 1988, and it was an 18, and I would have been 14 at the time. And as you probably know, in the UK, you can't go to a film with a guardian. You don't have the thing of like accompanied by a parent or guardian. Kids can't go and see like films, not like your degenerate nation where you a bad parent could take
See,
their kid to see The Exorcist at age two.
you can't get in even if there's a grown-up with you then.
Exactly.
You can't hire a bum off the street to take you to the movies.
Exactly. Although that doesn't stop people from trying to get in. As early as like 12, I was trying to get into 15s, and like, and then I went at 15, I was trying to get into 18s. I remember all the films that I got into underage, Gremlins, Highlander, The Lost Boys, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I remember them vividly.
What's your process there? Is this a single screen theater? Because that would be much harder. Because like once I was a kid and I
Yes.
realized I could buy a ticket to a PG movie and then walk into something, like, this is way before they had the reserve
I'm
seats.
guessing you did the one kid stacked on another kid's
No,
shoulders with a
with the
long
trench coat.
overcoat.
Two different strategies. Now, there's one, I told this story on Smartless, but I'll tell it again. The first 15 I ever got into in the UK, because we didn't have a PG-13, that didn't exist until Batman came out, where they created the 12, because Batman had been rated a 15, and there was such an uproar about Batman being a 15 that they created a new rating, the 12. That was the first ever 12 movie. Gremlins back in 1994 was a 15. Now, when Gremlins was rated 15, there were toys in the shops. There was the sticker album. The novelization was out. The kind of the picture book was out. The photo story book. So it was a bum deal for Gremlins because a lot of people wanted to see that movie that couldn't. And I was 10, and it was showing at my local cinema in Wells, Somerset, which was a single screen cinema. So our strategy, me and my brother, was we went along. We used to go to the Saturday morning film club at that cinema, and we went up to the manager, and they were showing Gremlins at the same time. And we took along a copy of the Gremlins novelization, and we said, "We want to see Gremlins, and we've read the book, and we know how it ends, so we're not going to be scared." And the manager said, "Come back later." And it was a relatively kind of like empty matinee, and he like looked around, his horse, he goes, "Get in there." And let
Oh,
us watch
awesome.
it, which was amazing. Now, later, getting into kind of like 15, then my strategy later would be that I'd try and appear like I was older. And that would be two different things, me wearing some of Dad's clothes, affecting a deeper voice. That didn't really work. I mean, I was a very youthful looking like 13-year-old as well. But the other thing that I thought, that maybe this is a weird thing that I thought that adults do, or certainly like teenagers do, is like had they had hair gel, they had product in their hair. So for some reason I thought, well, like if I slick my hair back, I'll look like a 15-year-old. And sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. Like I definitely didn't get into Predator. I definitely didn't get into The Fly or Aliens, got turfed away. But I did get into like The Lost Boys and Highlander and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which were all 15.
Nice. Show up smoking. That's another thing adults do. You could smoke cigarettes.
I didn't do that, but I should have. I wouldn't
Yeah,
have
but
been.
in England you can smoke cigarettes at 12, so that would
That would have been that should have been my strategy.
I think I have the novelization for Gremlins downstairs. I wish I had it now. Like that's a fun key to get into the movie. I've
Oh
already
yeah,
read the book.
I've read the
Yeah.
book. I can't be scared. I've read the book. I have the stickers.
Makes you seem a little more mature and literary as well. I
I should have
read
said
the
that with the running
Tolstoy
man, shouldn't I?
novel,
I should have
Gremlins.
said, I know I'm only 14 years old, but I happen to have read the Backman book, so I think you should let me in. I hear it's very different, by the way.
Although very interestingly enough, still credited to Richard Bachman, not to Stephen King.
Well, that was his choice, wasn't it? Like, I think he insisted that it be credited to Backman because it was so different.
The story that
That's
I
what
had
I that's what that's what I've heard, yeah.
yeah, well, we had oh God, I've just blanked on his name, the screenwriter from the original. He came on the
Stephen
show. What's that?
D'Souza.
That's right, Stephen E. D'Souza. He came on the show, and I think he told me that the reason why was because they didn't even know it was a Stephen King book until after all the contract stuff had been done. So
Yeah, that might have
it
been.
was probably optioned. I bet it was probably optioned when it when before the pseudonym was rumbled, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It definitely was, because I think that happened right before Thinner came out, the revelation, and I think Thinner came out like right around the time that they were just about to go into shooting. So,
Yeah, like
we were
87, I
talking.
think, right?
Yeah, I actually, because like I said, I got to meet him the other week and we talked about that. And he said that he, maybe you know this already, that he said that he knew he was on thin ice with Thinner because it was supernatural. And he had a feeling that that was the one that was going to get him found out.
Well, I think he got exposed partly because he uses dairy in The Running Man, and
Oh, right. Yeah.
the bookstore clerk who outed him, who wrote him the letter and said, "I think this is you," and then he came clean and he said, "Well, can I write an article about this?" And King was like, "Yes, just give me a moment to like tell certain people, and then you can expose it." I think he put it together that he saw dairy in The Running Man, and
That's
then
interesting.
was piecing because he also, I think it's in, is it in The Running Man or is it in Thinner? Like he mentions like Pennywise and the Killer Clowns as like a band or something. Like
I don't
he,
think that's in The Running Man. I
yeah.
might be, I mean, I'm now like super fans of it are gonna scold me if I'm wrong, but I don't
I
recall that being in The Running Man.
think, Eric, isn't there something in one of the books where he mentions, I think it might be Thinner, where he mentions
Yeah,
Pennywise.
that tracks. I don't know for sure either, but yeah, no, it was also like I think the thing that like solidified it based on my recollection of the story was that he also saw that the owner of the copyright was like Stephen King's manager or
Right.
something or
Yeah.
editor or like that. That was the once he saw that, he was just like, okay, I absolutely have this. But I'd like to talk a little bit about you're in an interesting position then, because you read the Bachman book before seeing the Schwarzenegger movie, which, you know, as you said, doesn't have much resemblance to the writing in the book. The writing in the book, you know, the Bachman stuff is mean. Like that's you know, the late great Scott Wampler, he would always say that the Stephen King writing as Richard Bachman is like King slicking his hair back and putting on his like greaser jeans and stuff. Like, this is bad boy Steve King. And
He's the Richard Stark to King's Donald
he
Westlake.
absolutely, absolutely. And he you know, and there's the Schwarzenegger movie is super fun. And matter of fact, I think it's a little underrated, to be honest. I think that it's playing in the same kind of weird, bizarre satire realm that like RoboCop was. I don't think it's as good as RoboCop, but I think that it's a little underrated in that aspect. But you know, as a fan of the book, it's like, you know, we never got that, and that's kind of, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is your adaptation. You know, definitely hews more and remembers that story is angry. And was that kind of one of the keystones of you like jumping into this and knowing that you needed to make something that you know, make a reason why a running man, you know, a new running man should exist?
I think it was also something where, aside from that, and I think in terms of the things about the book that are very prescient, and actually, I only found out I did this interview with Stephen yesterday, actually. That sounds like I keep name dropping. I apologize. But like, I didn't realize that he'd written it in 1972. So it like was written 10 years before it was published under Richard Bachman's name. But obviously, there's a lot of things in the themes of it that are kind of feel very sort of prophetic to where we are now, not least the fact that it's set in the year 2025. But the other thing that really stuck with me about the book that wasn't in the 1987 film, that also, like, when you read a book, like, even before I knew I wanted to be a director, you'd visualize like the book in your head. And so it always like stuck with me, that book, and also the fact that there was a Stephen King book that hadn't really been adapted. And I'd always been interested in doing something with The Running Man, and even maybe like 15 years ago, looked into the rights for it, which at the time were like not available, and it was all complicated. But the thing about it, which is like a sort of a key element, and when me and Michael Bacall first started putting our sleeves up to work on it, was about making it a completely subjective experience. Because that's something that's really vivid to me from the book, is that you're experiencing this game vicariously through Ben Richards. You don't have any information that he doesn't have. You're with him every step of the way. Like, you get to kind of like run alongside him. You feel like you're a contestant in the game. And obviously, a lot of other films in this kind of subgenre, including the 1987 one, if I say subgenre of dystopian game show films or TV, matter, they'll always like cut back to the network headquarters. You know, so the 1987 film will have scenes with Killian back at the TV station. You know, Squid Game will have scenes that behind the scenes that the contestants are not aware of. Hunger Games obviously has lots of scenes that are like separate from Katniss. Most of these films do that. And the book doesn't do that. And that was the key element, is like, you know, the intensity of it. And not just the intensity within the action sequences, but the intensity and the paranoia of scenes where nothing is happening. He just thinks it might. You know, it was something that's in the book that I thought, like a scene that really stuck with me, that's very much like present and correct in the movie, is the scene when he's in a hotel in New York and he basically freaks out and leaves when he doesn't have to. He just has this premonition of imminent death and thinks, I got to get the fuck out of here. Now, we only have his kind of like his like vision of what's about to happen to him, and he's probably right. But I still thought that's really strong. And it's also like, that's a moment where in a movie where you can be within a character's POV for the whole time, you can break out of that, because this is like his death dream, his little like sort of anxiety like dream of like, this is what's happening right now, and this is what the hammer's about to come down on me. I gotta go. And so a lot of those elements of the book were very vivid in my head. And, and when you're making a movie and you're working on the script, you do get those notes when you get studio notes. They're like, how about cutting back to what Sheila's up to or what Dan Killian's doing? And we're like, no, we really think it's really strong if you stick with Ben Richards the whole way, you know?
I thought the whole adaptation was extremely faithful, like surprisingly faithful. It starts even with him taking care of his baby and watching the Freevee, and there's the game show where there's like a heavy and unhealthy person on a treadmill. Like the all of the details are there, and I thought it was sort of unusual. Usually people change his stories around, but you really stuck to the outline of the story at the very least. And it seems like that must have been important to you up until, of course, the end, which we don't want to give away what happens in the movie, but I think it's kind of famous, the end of this book, as being bizarrely prophetic for 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this, it wasn't even a question of whether we were going to do that. Like, it wasn't even a thing that the studio said you can't. We had just said it ourselves, as obviously we're not doing that ending. So then it was about coming up with an ending that is in the same spirit but in a different way. And in fact, Stephen, when he read the screenplay before we'd even started shooting, he was very, very complimentary about the screenplay, and he said, I was curious to how you tackle the end, and I think you came up with a great solve. I really liked it. And I was like, great. I mean, I think we wanted to do something that had the same spirit and the same fire, but obviously, we weren't going to do that. And so I hope that, I mean, he Steven said the nicest thing about the finished film. And this was the first time I spoke to him on the phone, was I'd been emailing with him, and then we spoke on the phone after he'd watched it. And he hasn't actually seen the finished version. He saw like what was our, so we did two previews, and he saw the second preview version. And he was incredibly complimentary about it, and about Glenn as well. And then he said, it's faithful enough to keep the fans happy, but different enough to keep me excited. And I thought, well, I'll take that. I'll take that from the author. Like, so that was really, really kind of him and really generous. But also, it's something where we felt like, well, where we do have to make deviations, or we want to make some deviations, or do some things where we just expand on something, let's make sure it's within the same spirit. But to go back to the detail, though, the thing about Stephen's books, and some film adaptations get this, and some kind of just do a very basic version of it. But to me, when you read the books, I think the genius of his writing is almost outside of the genre elements. It's about grounding you in a real world. Now, that might be a future world like The Running Man, or it might literally be like sort of modern day Derry when he wrote it. But you really feel the specificity of the world and the relatability of the characters. And it's so, his books are so grounded that, and this it, with the best of the movies, it makes it kind of heartbreaking when the horror element starts to come in. And that's his genius. And so there's so much world building in the book, that we wanted to sort of take that and go even further. And that was really important to us. It's like, we've been given this kind of like amazing Bible full of detail in the book. Let's kind of take the ball and run with it. So we had a lot of fun, and also, I mean, you guys particularly will like spot a lot of kind of things that are like straight from the book, even with some of the brand names and stuff. And it's like just like fun to actually make those products,
Tabby's Diner and things like that. You have little
Oh,
references to
Fruity
him
Toot,
throughout.
Fun Twinks.
Yeah, the fun. Yeah, we were. Brez and I were actually talking about that right before you came on.
Yeah, Fun Twink cereal in the movie. When I saw that in the film, I was like, oh, interesting that that made it through.
It's like that had a different connotation, I think, when he wrote
Well,
it the first
that's a
time.
question I haven't asked him. I said, did that phrase exist back in 1982? I didn't know, but like, it's it. I When we had the first preview screening and that bit popped up, the audience like roared, and me and Michael McCool were like nudging each other, like, yeah, just because it was like snatches of unlikely, like belly laugh at that, especially after somebody's just died, you know?
I won't spoil some of the bigger nods, but I will tell anybody going into the movie, pay, you know, if you're a Stephen King fan of the movies, fan of the adaptations, anytime there's a name tag or a store sign somewhere, you just pay close attention to that stuff. You'll see some familiar
You know
names.
what? I actually thought that you guys more. I actually thought about you, like there's a scene in the changing room when you go into the network building and you see like the shows are color coded, so people are like trying out for shows, but then you know the kind of the powers that be will denote like sort of who does what. And of course, unfortunately, like Ben Richards is like sort of designated to be on the running man in the deep scarlet jumpsuits, the most dangerous ones. But you see all these other colored jumpsuits, and I did think when we were doing that scene, and you see all the other surnames above, I thought Eric's gonna like this.
Well, I did.
So
I was
I thought of you.
good. Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking you were about to say I was going to put Eric's name on there too, but that would have been nobody would have gotten that one. Nobody would
Well, I'll
have.
say, listen, I mean, listen, this isn't a big spoiler. I'll talk about this one because it relates to another Stephen King story. So, this is a good Easter egg. But in that scene, and you see, it's actually in the trailer. So if you look at the trailer, you could see it quickly. You see all the other jumpsuits, and there are surnames of the contestants. And I thought, well, let's just do all actors that have been in Stephen King adaptations, so Stephen King films, including King. Because obviously King, among many appearances, if I was had to say, it would be Creepshow because he's a major character in Creepshow. So that's a King jumpsuit. It's like lime green, and it's for a show called Bug Out, like something that like Michael Bacall came up with. And it's like I don't even want to know what that show is, and I definitely do not want to be on it. So after New York Comic Con, we went there with I went there with Glenn and Lee to do the first like press for the movie. And I wanted to meet. I emailed Steven and said, "Hey, I'd love if there's a chance to meet you before the film comes out. I'm going to be in New York. Are you in Maine this weekend? Could I come up and see you?" And he was, and he said that it would be amazing. Are you sure? You know, he was like, "You're really going to come to Bangor?" He was actually happened to be in Bangor that weekend, so I went to meet him in the old house and have dinner. And
Incredible.
I wanted to bring him a present, so I brought him the King jumpsuit.
Oh, nice.
So he has it.
He could put his name tag on it and
He's already got the name tag.
from Shaun of the Dead, just
Oh, I
combine
see.
them.
Yeah, he
Oh,
can put
yeah.
that on as well. No, so he has
You're
the King.
providing him a wardrobe, is what we're saying.
Oh, sorry?
You're providing him a wardrobe, is what we're saying.
He's
Each
got the
movie.
King jumpsuit. He was very excited to receive it as well.
Did he ever talk to you about where he was in his life when he wrote this book? I know it was written in 72. People kind of mistakenly believe it was written later because it was published later, but it was written pre-Carrie. I think he said, he told me he wrote it over the span of like a few days, that it was like this sort of torrent that poured out of
Yeah,
him. But it was.
he talked a little bit about it. I think it was in that period where like he's you know trying to provide, and you know he wrote that book thinking it would like, and he said he sent it to a publisher that was it originally on Signet in 1982? Is that the publisher maybe? But
I think
I don't
so.
remember.
he said that when he sent it to a publisher in 1972, they rejected it, says, "We don't do dystopian fiction." Which is like, wait, so you wouldn't publish 1984 by George Orwell? What's that mean?
No.
But yeah, I think it was a sort of a thing where, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but probably that's a period with some of the Bachman books where it's like, you know, books that will sell in terms of like, I mean, I don't say like pulpy in a kind of like derogatory way, but like sort of like, you know, like a science fiction novel that's like it's kind of like it's a proper like page turner, and it's lean and it's mean. And I think so he is writing things fast as a way like of just kind of being able to kind of provide for his family as a writer. So that's the sense that I got with that. And then it didn't get picked up and he moved on, and then it came back around when I guess after the other Bachman books are to be published.
Well, it struck me because, and I think you capture this really well in the film, the desperation that Ben Richards feels. His daughter needs medicine for her pneumonia. His wife is working late at
Not even
night in a
pneumonia, flu.
with the
That's the
pneumonia
thing.
flu.
It's it was just like that. That's it's very specific that it's like they need money for flu meds.
Well, and his wife is working at a diner. In real life, Tabby King worked at Dunkin' Donuts at that period in their lives. She was pulling the midnight shift at Dunkin' Donuts, and they had their daughter Naomi. And one of the reasons he threw away Care, you probably know the famous story about how he put it in the trash and Tabby rescued it from the garbage. He put it in the garbage because he knew it was getting too long, and he had these five unpublished books, one of which is The Running Man. And he knew, I can't sell a novel, but I can sell short stories. And so the desperation, that idea of like, I'll just do anything for money. And I need it for my kids' medicine was something he literally experienced when he was pumping gas and working as a school teacher and trying to make ends meet. So I thought you did a great job. I wondered if he ever talked about that sort of the reality he was living that fed this character and this premise.
He did say the other day that he said one line about that I think says everything and sort of speaks to Ben and Sheila. He says, our kids were eating better than us. So I think it's something where they're providing for their kids. That doesn't mean that they're like sort of like that they're like sort of sacrificing everything for their kids. I mean, I think, the thing, like the opening scenes of the movie were some of the tougher things to write and sort of like balance. And actually, it's interesting. The first scene in the movie was Simon Kinberg's idea because originally the first draft, me and Michael Bacall worked on the treatment, and then he did the first two drafts on his own. And the first draft started with the sort of speed the wheel scene and him in the apartment with the baby, and much as it is in the film. And Simon Kinberg said, maybe there's a scene in him because you understand that like Ben's trying to do what he can and he's begged for his old job back. And he's not somebody who would easily swallow their pride and do that. So you understand that it's a big deal for him to go back to an abusive boss and beg for his job back. And in the first draft of the script, that's talked about but not seen. And Kinberg said, what if that was the opening scene? Is there something in that? And he was right, and it was that then that was became the opening scene of the film. And in fact, I was really happy because Stephen King said, "Oh, I like the opening scene where he's begging for his job back," and I was like, "Great." You know what? What movie actually I just seen, and I told Michael Bacall about it because I thought it was a great opening scene of a movie. And it's not exactly the same as our scene, but it did. I when we were talking about that, and Kinberg had suggested that idea for the scene, I'd just seen Emily the Criminal, and I thought that that opening scene with Aubrey trying to get a job. And then seeming like she's doing well in the interview, and then the like the employer kind of letting on that he knows far more about her record than he's previously, she thinks she's doing well until he says, "Well, I understand that this happened." I that really stuck with me, that scene. Obviously, like we're doing something a bit like different, but like it was yeah, so that I was really happy that Stephen liked that scene because it was something that kind of like came out of a note and it was a really good one.
How did you decide to credit him as Stephen King rather than Richard Bachman? Because we see the like executive produced by Stephen King pop up during the opening credits. And then when you say like based on the novel, you went with Stephen King instead of Bachman. Like what was the decision there?
I don't think it was even a de I don't actually think it was actually even a decision. I think because the books have been republished under his name.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I
I
think
guess.
it would be us. I think if we did that, it would seem like we were trying to be too cool for school.
Too cheeky.
It's like, and also to be honest, a lot of people who've seen the Arnold Schwarzenegger film see our trailer and said, "Oh, I didn't know that was a Stephen King book." I've had several people say that to me. I think in a way, and also the fact that he was, he has the kind of the say so of whether, like of whether he has a producer credit or not. So, and he's really proud of the movie. So I was like, I sing it from the rooftops that it's a Stephen King novel.
Well, we're running low on time here, but I did want to shout out one thing, one element that I always loved in the book that obviously isn't really there at all in the 80s movie that you lean into in this one, and that is the complicity of the audience and them being motivated either by fame or being part of something or the money that they desperately need to help be part of the hunt for the running man. And so can you maybe talk a little bit about the decision to lean into that? Because you show a few different versions of that, which I really
Well,
love.
yeah, I think that's something again that really stuck with me about the book. I mean, is that, you know, we're presenting a world where like life is cheap, and you know, murder is presented on TV as entertainment, and it's really interesting watching it with an audience because when the first on-screen death happens, it's in an otherwise comic scene. And I think when people watch it, the when we watch it, you know, it's wild watching it with a test screening audience because they haven't seen a single frame, and they've got chuckles at the scene that comes before it, and then there's like a collective whoa, like
Yeah,
it's
you're
really
right.
cold. And it's also it's an actor that you like, and so you're like whoa, okay, like this is happening, and it's something like yeah, did you forget what the premise of the game was? This is the way it's going, guys. I mean, one of the things that was like really like an ambitious part of making the movie is not only like Ben's story, is just building out the world. And you know, in different sequences of the movie, you see what happens to the other contestants, but you also see like supercuts of previous editions, both in the opening credits. There's a thing like we call like the hardest hits. It's almost like a Jackass compilation of other death. Now, to do that compilation, we shot 32 separate murder scenes, and some of them are by the hands of hunters, and some of them are by the hands of the public. And so we just had a spitball like of ideas for like different like death, and like some of them like eye shot, and a lot of them like second unit shot or stunt shot. But like we was trying to come up with like what different deaths we wanted to show. Who's the killer? Is it McCone? Is it a hunter? Is it a member of the public? But that's something I think that, you know, the complicity of the audience is really important to it. And also the growing understanding that people understand that, you know, the show has a manipulated narrative, and then an understanding by the audience that they're being manipulated as well. And I think that's something that people, I guess, you know, since he wrote the novel, and since even like the publication or even the original film, you know, there's been 25 years of a certain type of reality show on TV, whether it's like, you know, the kind of the Bravo type shows or game shows
Fear
where,
Factor is a big one, right? Fear
yeah, but even
Factor.
like sort of like just even like singing competitions, like American Idol and X Factor, the molding of a narrative, like the villain edit, who's going to be the fool guy? Who's there to be made fun of? Who's going to be the villain of the piece? Is it going to be one of the judges? Is it going to be one of the contestants? People, you know, over the years have got wise to like how TV shows are edited and manipulated. And like, you know, the scene in the book where, you know, he makes a tape in Bradley's apartment, which is then, you know, kind of like edited like to make him say something that he didn't, is in the book and is obviously like something that is happening on a daily basis in like media and in social media, and everybody's sort of aware of like the like what is true and what is not, and what things have been edited and what things are completely fabricated. And you know, so that was a big part of it as well. And also the, like you know, an audience out there starting to understand that this is happening, and the scale starting to fall off people's eyes. All of this was really important to our adaptation, you know?
It
Yeah.
is, yeah. It's a
Wonderful.
surprisingly prescient book, man. He really predicted a lot of things that
Yeah.
are really here in 2025, and he said it in 2025, so
Yeah.
that's kind of funny too. Thanks for being with us, Edgar. It was really great to talk to you.
Well, What a great occasion to finally come onto your podcast.
Many thanks to Edgar Wright and the cast for joining us. Again, this isn't our typical format, so you'll have to let us know what you think. I definitely obviously like the longer form. That's where we get comfortable. That's where we can go down the blind alleyways and whatnot. But I don't think from time to time it's a bad idea to, you know, to get some of the star power on the show if we can only get him for 5 or 6 minutes to get that Stephen King origin story out of him. You know, because it does kind of, you know, it's kind of like a thumbprint. Like you could look the same and sound the same, you know, in certain ways, but they're all slightly different, you know, which I love. And I think it's a really good way to kind of find out, you know, just how nerdy about Stephen King people are. So I don't know. I liked it. I hope you guys did too.
You know, the one thing we didn't get to the bottom of is whether the Running Man dance owes any kind of origin to the book or the movie, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. What do you think? Coincidence? Or did Stephen King give us the greatest modern dance move?
I mean, listen, man, you fucking print the legend. So I'm going to say absolutely. You know, the inventor of the Running Man was reading Richard Bachman one night and was like, you know what? You know what? We don't have enough in this world. Dance moves inspired by dystopian Pulp Fiction. So
we need a dance move that any mediocre white guy can do.
One that I probably pulled out on when I was forced to dance by our fucking DJ at the wedding. So
I think I did see a little Running Man there. Yeah. I assume that was a King cast Easter egg.
It was. Your wedding. I do not dance, but there was obviously a lot of my friends didn't either. So at the wedding, the DJ noticed this and like made up a little game that ended up getting people on the dance floor. And
that was a brilliant game. That was very clever.
It was very
otherwise
clever.
People don't dance.
They Gotta don't. And you know what? People dance. The only people dancing at the reception for the wedding were Elijah Wood's children and the flower girl. Like the kids, they were all on the dance floor. They didn't give a shit, but
kids love to dance.
None of my friends were dancers until he pulled that stunt. And you know what? There was always somebody dancing, you know, after that. So yes, the little peek at the Vespi wedding reception there. Maybe we'll talk about it. We'll do like another catching up episode where we kind of discuss all the stuff that we've been up to, and we can go more in depth about the whole wedding honeymoon shit if anybody gives a shit about hearing that. But I just wanted to say thanks for listening to this episode on The Running Man. We both have seen the movie. We both really like the movie, and we'll go a little bit more in depth on it at a later time. We'll let everybody see it first, then we can talk about some of the more detailed stuff on it.
All right. Till then.
All right. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.